Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin with the Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. And we have on our show today, Dr. Cornelius Hunter, author of Science's Blind Spot, The Unseen Religion of Scientific Naturalism. Dr. Hunter is a biophysicist and a fellow here at the Discovery Institute, and he has written on a number of subjects, including the science side of evolution, the theology and philosophy side of evolution, the philosophy of science side of this debate, and I think that this is finally his foray into philosophy of science, and we're very happy to have you on the show with us today, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you very much, Casey. It's good to be here.
Can you first tell us a little bit about your scientific training?
Well, I am both an engineer and a biophysicist. My doctorate is in biophysics and computational biology from the University of Illinois. My life science research interests are primarily in the area of protein structures.
Your new book is titled Science's Blind Spot, The Unseen Religion of Scientific Naturalism. What do you mean when you say science's blind spot?
Well, we've all heard the joke about the guy with the hammer, and to him everything looks like a nail. Well, science's hammer is naturalism, and to science, everything in the world, everything that has ever occurred, must be the result of a naturalistic process. A chemistry problem is, in principle, no different than figuring out the origin of human consciousness. So like the guy with the hammer who sees everything as a nail, to science, everything looks like a purely naturalistic problem. Science's blind spot is that it cannot distinguish, it cannot say, gee, maybe the origin of consciousness cannot be completely explained with naturalism. All problems look alike to science.
But can a scientist do research without assuming naturalism?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with assuming naturalism up front. That's what I do in my research. But if we're going to do that, then we need to be clear that we've made that assumption and understand that this assumption does place limits on the research. Now, we have this situation today where evolutionists claim, on the one hand, that the only way one can do scientific research is by assuming naturalism. And then, on the other hand, they tell us that evolution is a fact, that it is true. Now, isn't that an amazing piece of good fortune? It just so happens that the very constraints that evolutionists have a priori placed on science has led them to the truth. Science can only work assuming naturalism, and gee, here we have a naturalistic theory turning out to be true. What luck.
It's kind of like in computer programming, you have garbage in, garbage out, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like a mathematician proclaiming that math can only be done using odd numbers, and then he finds that all solutions are in the form of odd numbers. But luck.
Well, one of the surprising messages in Science's Blind Spot is that this assumption of naturalism comes from the church. Can you explain that?
Right. So where does this come from? Why are these people assuming naturalism? Isn't this just atheism in disguise? No, it isn't. If you look at where these arguments are coming from, these people are not atheists. It comes from the history of thought in the early days of modern science. So after Francis Bacon and René Descartes got modern science going, then they argued for naturalism because it was the assumption of naturalism because it's a good way to figure out how nature works. And they were reacting to Aristotelianism, and that was fine. But in later years, a much more profound argument was made, namely that naturalism is true, not just a good method in a laboratory, but it's a true description of nature. That is, the argument was made that God works exclusively via natural, or what theologians refer to as secondary causes. This argument took many forms, as it was made by a variety of theologians and philosophers, both on the continent and in England, over roughly a two-century period from the mid-17th century to the mid-19th century. So today's origins debate inherits all of this baggage. If you look at today's arguments, they come straight out of that history.
Well, that's one of the things that I really enjoy about your writing, Dr. Hunter, is that you are very good at synthesizing so many different areas, whether it's the scientific evidence, as I said, the philosophy, the theology, and you just were talking about the difference between, I think you mentioned historical sciences, and you obviously did, I think, experimental science, where you said that assuming naturalism worked quite well. Can you explain the difference between historical science and experimental science, and how does this assumption of naturalism, this methodological naturalism, interface with these different types of science?
Right. It's a big question. Science consists of a wide spectrum of activities that are difficult to categorize and circumscribe. Philosophers have been trying for centuries to explain what is science and what is not science, the demarcation problem. But ever since Kant, it's been understood that there seems to be something different between, on the one hand, analyzing how nature works, and on the other hand, analyzing how nature arose in the first place. So the experimental sciences are the former. It's hard to draw an unambiguous line between the two, but it's clear that there is something going on, that there's some difference. Mm. The experimental sciences are well-developed. They're very successful. They bring us all kinds of good results. The historical sciences, on the other hand, are in a seemingly endless struggle with the data. In the laboratory, we don't need typically to modify the natural laws of nature to explain what we observe. Things fall into line rather well. But with the evolutionary theories, we're constantly having to modify and patch up the theories and add epicycles in order to explain what we observe.
So you wouldn't say that necessarily all historical sciences are at odds with the data, just certain historical sciences?
Right, absolutely. There's a wide variety of historical sciences, and there's many success stories in the historical sciences. I don't mean to make it sound like it's all having trouble.
Well, and this actually goes back to what you talk about in your book, though. You talk about the fact that Darwinism doesn't make good scientific predictions. So what are some areas where you feel that Darwinism has made weak predictions?
Right, well, first, evolution has been problematic since Darwin proposed the theory. When he proposed evolution, there were many scientific problems. Things have not gotten better since then. It's not the case that evolution does well in most areas and there's just a few minor problems around the edges. Evolution has problems across the board. I want to just give you one example, and that would be the DNA code, which was discovered about 50 years ago. And so the DNA code is what translates the information in the DNA to be used in making protein. It's a fascinating molecular apparatus that does this. The very existence of a code, of course, is quite a challenge for evolution to explain. So that in and of itself is a problem. But beyond that, when the DNA code was discovered, evolutionists had to predict that the code was not unique. It was not special. Because the code is universal amongst the species, it had to have evolved early on. When the first bacteria came about, the DNA code was there. It was an accident. It was a fortuitous accident, according to evolutionists. And it wasn't a particularly useful code as codes go. It was just like any other code. One if I land, two if I see code could be the other way around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same with the evolutionists have argued that the DNA code would be like that, too. It's arbitrary. Mm. You could switch it around to work just as well. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, nowadays we know that that prediction is false. The DNA code is a one in a million code, so to speak. It's got all kinds of unique and special properties that make it an intricate part of the cell's design. So what we find inevitably in biology always is a struggle for evolution to explain.
Mm. And of course, under evolutionary biology, if there is a particular solution that is needed, they will just say, well, see, this shows natural selection is good at searching out biology space and coming up with the right answer. And if it's some cobbled together thing that they say doesn't work very well, then they say, oh, look, this shows that evolution is just a tinkering machine that doesn't actually do a very good job of solving problems. You end up with these situations where, what does the theory really predict?
Well, right, and that's where evolutionists would disagree that it's struggling. They would view it as succeeding quite nicely, thank you. And that gets to one of the important distinctions between the experimental and historical sciences that we talked about a moment ago. I do go over that in my book. So there's half a dozen or so important distinctions between experimental and historical sciences, and one of them is that when you have a problem in historical sciences, you can draw upon one-time contingencies. Well, a comet hit, there's an ice age, this happened, that a mutation happened, and you can draw upon these unseen events that can either be proven or unproven, and just there's a rich pool of explanatory devices that can be used to explain things. And then in the historical sciences, the problems can linger like that. They just kind of, we're not quite sure about that yet, but we'll work on it. Now, could be this, could be that. In experimental science, if you've got an observation that isn't jiving with a well-established theory, then that's of high interest, and scientists don't make up contingencies to explain it.
My question that always piques my interest regarding your work is, what inspires a biophysicist to write about philosophy of science?
Well, good question. I certainly wasn't planning on going in that direction in the first place. What intrigued me was the high claims of evolutionists when I studied the theory of evolution and read that it was a fact, and it's true, and beyond a doubt, it's true as gravity. It's as true as the roundness of the Earth. That's a very high claim. And for something that happened in the past, long ago, that must be some very interesting information, must be some very interesting proofs or data to back that up. So I began to look for that and read through the textbooks and popular literature and the research articles and, deeper and deeper, and found that it was really hard to find the meat. Where's the meat behind this? Well, how do you prove this to be a fact or to be true? Yet that is the universal claim. That's the consensus position, that it is a fact. And it's really that claim that reveals that there's something going on. That should raise a red flag for people. When you see that sort of a claim, something's interesting going on here. Well, and that's where you search through the evolutionary literature and you find, well, they do write about why they think it's a fact. It is clearly stated. You can find it. And those reasons are metaphysical. They talk about the relationship between nature and God, and they talk about what God would and would not do, and the ultimate metaphysical truths are being foisted. This was all running all through Darwin's book, and it runs through all today's literature. You can find it in evolutionary textbooks. You can find it in the popular literature. It manifests itself more subtly in research programs and articles. But Darwin didn't make this stuff up, and that's what's important. He, in fact, never defended any of his claims about God. They were baked in by that time. They come from the 200 years leading up to Darwin or so. You can trace it to, as I said earlier, a variety of thinkers. And
so basically, you saw that it wasn't science that was holding Darwin's theory together, so it had to be something else. And when you dug deeper, you found that it was more philosophy and metaphysics.
That's right. What's interesting is evolutionists are very open about this. This is not being hidden at all, but it's so obvious to evolutionists to them it's not controversial.
Well, so this is book number 3. Will there be a book number 4?
Well, good question. I didn't think there would be a book number 2. And then I didn't think there would be a book number 3. It all depends on if there's something important to write about. I just don't know at this time.
Well, I have a feeling you're going to find something more to write about. You always have written some very interesting books, of course, starting off with Darwin's God, Evolution and the Problem of Evil, and then Darwin's Proof. And then now coming out with Science's Blind Spot, The Unseen Religion of Scientific Naturalism. Dr. Cornelius Hunter, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Casey, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Be sure to check out Science's Blind Spot, The Unseen Religion of Scientific Naturalism. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.